Welcome to the Full Tracy Monday Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 8:46 p.m. and that is British summer time. And today is August 7th, and today's my last day in the UK. I'm flying back tomorrow, so I expect to record the audio tomorrow when I get home, which probably would be about 5 p.m. Local time, which would probably be probably posted then around 11 p.m. in UK time. But I thought we'd kick off today and look at the oil price. I think we can very clearly state that it has broken the downtrend. We're back above the 200-day moving average. It has broken the sequence of lower rally highs, and we give the benefit of the doubt to the upside, provided it is holding that move above the $80 level. Now, there are a couple of different reasons that the oil price is going higher. I guess the first one is that global growth has been reasonably steady, so that's on the demand side. But then you have the supply side, and OPEC Plus is cutting supply. That's being driven right now by Saudi Arabia. They want to ensure that prices are higher. When you want to build a 75-mile-long city, it certainly helps that if your finances are in order. And certainly, a higher oil price is greatly assisting in that ambition. But I guess what we're starting to see now is some speculation about what are Russia's intentions. And obviously, there is a full offensive going on by Ukraine to try and recapture territory in the eastern portion of the country. And then we're starting to see an escalation of targets. So the number of targets has certainly increased. And now you're starting to see that Ukraine is targeting Moscow, and that they're also starting to attack oil tankers. In fact, I'm surprised that oil prices are actually down today in view of the fact that Ukraine attempted to sink one of their, or at least attack one of Russia's tankers in the Black Sea over the weekend. And then you have on the other side, you have Russia that is trying to bomb Ukraine's export facilities for grain. And they also have control of the largest nuclear reactor in Europe, or perhaps even the world. So that's obviously an escalation. So are we going to see it continue to escalate? Will Ukraine, with the aid of advanced rocketry, be able to target Russia's oil export facilities? And of course, then they risk also damaging the export pipeline for Kazakhstan, because there are no restrictions on buying oil from Kazakhstan, but it seems to travel in the same pipeline as Russian oil. So obviously that's rather complicated. And I think that's perhaps why there isn't quite as much angst about the attack on a Russian tanker. But the nature of war is that there are lots of surprises, and we are definitely seeing an escalation. So potentially then, what will Russia do? Could they decide to instead go for an embargo? And this is something that's beginning to be explored by institutional investors. I saw a report over the weekend discussing it. And so this isn't an idea I came up with on my own, but when we start to think about that, could Russia implement an embargo? One of the biggest challenges they have is that a lot of those wells that are drilled into the permafrost can't exactly be turned off. The technical difficulty of actually getting them down there in the first place, their age, and then the difficulty then of trying to restart one would be rather just beyond the scope. So they can't exactly shut down their supply, but they could just decide to not sell it at all to anyone other than China or perhaps India. But or they might just shut down lots of their supply and leave going those that are necessary for supporting domestic demand. There's lots of potential outcomes. But when we see a breakout like this, we have to at least give the benefit of the doubt to the upside, and there are likely to be some news stories that come along to support the price. And then, of course, we also know that we're now in August. There's going to be an election in the USA in November of 2024 for president. And it's a big doubt whether Donald Trump will in fact be able to run. He's already said that he would run from prison, which holds out the potential for almost a pantomime kind of election process. But the reality is that what Russia really needs to do if they want to damage Ukraine is to damage the resolve of all those countries that are sending armaments to Ukraine. And significantly higher energy prices could achieve that goal. So potentially we're going to see higher oil prices overall. Now, we're not seeing that reflected in the inflation figures at present. But it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that having had inflationary pressures coming down, that they might start to re-up, and that we might now, in fact, see a higher plateau. Now, that's not the base case. And I think when we look at the process of quantitative tightening, it's very clearly evident in the chart of the central bank balance sheets redenominated into US dollars. And it is at a new low. It is continuing to extend the sequence of lower rally highs and lower lows. And it has unwound now approximately half of the big run-up in 2020 through to the beginning of 2020, excuse me, of 2020 through to 2022. And the global total of central bank balance sheets is now at about 28.6 trillion. But as recently as the beginning of 2022, it was around 33. So we've had almost 5 trillion knocked off the total assets of central bank balance sheets, and that's a lot of tightening. Now, I don't often show this additional measure of deficit spending, but the thing that really stands out to me is that in 1999, the global balance sheet for deficits was actually in negative territory. So we in fact had governments that had more money than they knew what to do with. And then we had a big pop on the upside. And what this chart has tended to do is go sideways. Whenever there's a major crisis, it takes a leg higher and then it never comes back down. And then we had this huge surge again in 2019. And despite the fact that the spending that was associated with the pandemic has ceased to increase, the total number of deficits, when you aggregate them across the same countries that where you have the central bank balance sheet indicator, we're still at a deficit of about 1.75 trillion. And that's about the middle of the range. Now, this particular measure tends to jump around a lot because not every country reports their fiscal spending at the same time. So it won't look exactly the same on any given day, but the trend is pretty clear. So there's a lot more money being spent than is being taken in, and at the same time, we have central banks that are reducing the size of their balance sheets. And that removal of assistance generally tends to sap inflationary pressures. But of course, then you have commodities being a wild card. And oil prices, with the potential to pop on the upside from here, would certainly be a fly in the ointment and a rather difficult thing to rationalize from the perspective of central banks. They might, in fact, be forced to raise rates higher than they might want to. And then, of course, we have gold prices, which are down about $6 in here today. We had a little upside Q reversal on Friday, but you'd really have to take out a magnifying glass to see it, and no upside follow through in here today. So we're still in this broad period of consolidation. And I remain very much of the view that it is negative real rates are the driving force. Now, of course, when we look at the power of the inverse correlation between the dollar and gold, the dollar is a very significant factor. But what we also definitely tend to see is that the outlook for negative real rates tends to be a contributing factor in whether we have a bull market for the dollar or not. And having had the negative, the well, I guess it's real rates pop on the upside again, that is sapping some of the demand for gold. So it's when this trend turns lower, that's generally when we have the big moves in gold, and it tends to coincide with a weaker dollar environment. Now, let's then just pay attention also to what's happening in Japan, because there's a lot of speculation right now about what exactly is going to happen in terms of stimulus in China, but it's not happening yet. Whereas in Japan, they have been deeply committed to their yield curve control policy, and even though they have now altered it and they have obfuscated, so they have said one thing, then qualified it, then qualified it again, and then intervened several days later. So it's a very messy situation. But I think the message is clear. They're willing to devalue the currency, they just don't want it to go in a straight line. And the yen was weaker again in here today. Now, whenever it looks like the yen might weaken, then the Japanese stock market tends to steady up. And the Nikkei today bounced from the lower side of its range, and so did the TOPIX. And of course, the TOPIX is a market cap weighted index, whereas the Nikkei is a price average. So, in this type of environment, it's potentially true that the topics might outperform. And it is really rather steady, holding the move above the 2200 point level. And at this is, we really need to look at a phenomenally large amount of data to put into perspective just how lengthy the base formation is. And this is a clear first step above the base. So there are lots of moving parts to the global market picture, but this is a very bullish pattern overall for Japan. And when we think then about some of the performance that we're having, well, Zed Holdings is Yahoo Japan. So it's a search engine and advertising business. And it collapsed between 2021, late 21, and early 2023, put in a mild base, and now it's breaking higher, and that's on stronger earnings. So we've had a lot of volatility, but if we excise the pandemic swing, then the price right now is pretty much where it was in 2018, and that was the lower side of the range. So there's the potential for recovery in here. Then, when I think about the broad fintech sector, I think there's a lot of growth there, and potentially true that companies like Square or Afterpay, what they have successfully done is capture the attention of the younger demographic. And what we've seen from social media companies is that once you capture the demographic, you can monetize it. So that's basically the business model that they've tried to do. And of course, you have Jack Dorsey as the CEO, and he has experience building social media platforms like Twitter. Now, of course, Twitter never really succeeded in getting a monetization model moving, but the logic is the same. And when you think about companies like Square, well, the chances are they paid too much for Cash App, and that's now being excised in the valuation. Of course, then they renamed the company Block, and that was in service to the blockchain and trying to latch on to the meme quality of the name. But what we saw yesterday, or I guess on Friday, was that they beat on their earnings, and they're making more money, and they are selling more. But that wasn't good enough to justify the valuation. So the share dropped in a really precipitous manner, and this continues to look like a developing base formation, and the bias is on the downside right now. So the price right now is ranging above 50, and it spent a good portion of time between 2018 and 2020 also ranging above 20, or excuse me, 50. So it's going to have to demonstrate that it can monetize that demographic of young people that it has captured, that the first experience with credit that many of those young people have had is with these app purchases and the ability to pay over time. And what companies like Block will then have to do is to extend that into traditional credit as young people get jobs, get more secure income, build credit profiles, and eventually start funding larger purchases like cars and homes. And of course, Block will want to do that, want them to do that through their platform. Of course, that platform for larger loans doesn't actually exist, and it's something that they'll have to build over time. So they're going to have to demonstrate to investors that they can execute on that growth strategy. And until they can do that, I suspect that we're going to be in this lengthy base formation. And this is quite normal after a big bust where the valuation has been extraordinary. Well, then investors, they start to become a bit leery of the growth story and start looking for evidence. And I think that's basically where we are right now. Then I think it's rather interesting here what we're seeing with the biotech sector. And it's very volatile. And we have lots of different companies within the biotech ETF, and some up, some down. But when they're down, they tend to be down a lot. And we've had some very big moves. So the biotech ETF is breaking on the downside. And this is not a happy looking chart pattern. But then we have the performance of companies like the Amgen, which falls into the bigger number, the bigger companies. So they've just had a successful cancer drug permissioned, or at least they're starting to look like it'll be permissioned. So the share has popped up here, and now it's testing the $250 area. That's been an area of resistance on several occasions over the last 3 years, but at least it is bouncing from the 1,000-day moving average and doing so again. And then let's also just pay attention to Gilead Sciences. The share is beginning to look like it has first step above the base characteristics. So these are larger companies, and they've been engaged in trying to find new drugs for a really long time. And I often think of the biotech sector as rather akin to the mining sector, that you come up with a new idea and then you have to prove it up, and you go through multiple rounds of raising funds, and each one of the new suite of investors have different risk appetites and require more or less proof. And then eventually you start to reach commercialization. And by the time you reach commercialization, then the original originators of the idea may or may not still be in the business. And this is what we tend to see happening in the biotech sector, but we also tend to see it happening in the mining sector. And there is a solid business model within biotech that you can get a company up to a certain size, and then it will get taken out by in a mergers and acquisitions move. And I think that we see very similar types of activity within the mining sector too. But I think it's also important to think about these two ways of, or I guess the similarities between an exceptionally high technology sector and what is basically a sector devoted to digging holes. But from a risk attitude, then the potential for reward in biotech is multiples and has much longer lead times than we do have in the mining sector. But then, of course, occasionally you will find a mother lode in the mining sector that will turn into a world-class mine. But those occasions are blindingly small. So when we think then about biotechnology, it is definitely technology based. The big argument for a secular bull market is that energy is now more of a technology than it is about resources. That mining is more about technology driven than it is about digging holes. And I think these are reasonable arguments in a bull market, but we definitely need to see that, for example, a big breakthrough in battery technology would create would really enhance the argument that now energy is more about the technology side rather than the availability of basic resources and digging holes. When we think about healthcare, well, then there isn't the same argument that it is purely about technology and that there will be more companies that benefit simply because of the enhanced ability to analyze data, and that companies that are more technology driven and are looking for ways to enhance the availability and the ability to really delve into the relationships that you have in big data, those are the ones that will thrive over the long term. And obviously, those that have the financial resources to do that will be in a stronger position. So, even though we have a lot of variability within the biotech sector, we're definitely starting to see greater interest in it. When we think then about the healthcare sector from an investor's perspective, well, we've had a lot of variability, but those that are focusing on the earnings capacity of the sector, those that have dividends, well, that is still firing here. And there's still quite a lot of investor interest in companies that can weather inflationary patterns, those that have the ability to increase dividends and reward investors. So the Dividend Aristocrats ETF has broken out and then found support in the region of the upper side of its range. It has a very similar pattern overall to the Dow Jones, which has also broken on the upside and now is firming from the upper side of that underlying range. And that is despite the fact that Apple is unwinding its overbought condition relative to the 200-day moving average. So my short or my put position went into profit today. And now I'm thinking about whether I should just put in an in-the-money stop. Now, I think it is quite likely that Apple will unwind its overbought condition relative to the 200-day moving average. I think it was inevitable that sales of iPhones were going to deteriorate because there is a very well-defined 3-year cycle in terms of the battery. I know that myself because I bought a new phone back in late 2021. So it's a bit more than a year and a half old, and the efficiency of the battery, I looked it up before I started recording, is about 84% now. So it's no longer recharging to the full 100%, and a year from now, it's probably not going to be recharging more than 50%. And anyone who bought a phone in 2021 is going to be looking at refinancing, buying a new one in 2024. So there's ample pent up potential demand a year from now, but that doesn't mean that sales are going to be anything to write home about between now and then. So there's certainly the potential that we're going to have a bit of chop and change in terms of performance because it's the Dividend Aristocrat, the more reliable balance sheet type companies are doing better right now. And the exceptionally large companies, where there's been a lot of growth, has been assumed. Well, then I think investors are probably now more in a mood to demand some proof. So that's one of the reasons why Apple is unwinding this overbought condition. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.